Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here on this September 20th, 2017 rainy morning. And I would like to call into order our House Interim Committee on Transportation Policy. Nice to see you all. It feels like it's been a very long time. We have an agenda today that I think you're going to find very interesting, but the first thing that we need to do is adopt committee rules. Those of you who've already been in a committee, you've seen these, and I would be open to a motion to adopt committee rules.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the House Interim Committee on Transportation Policy proposed rules as distributed.
Thank you. Vice Chair Vile moves adoption of committee rules. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. And let's just call Mr. Mather up and open our informational hearing. The first item on our agenda is an update on major transportation projects. I assume you've had a busy summer, Mr. Mather.
We have, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I'm going to show you what ODOT's been up to over the summer, touch on a few projects, and then a couple of topics that have really kind of dominated our summer. One was the eclipse and the traffic associated with that, and the other more recently has been the fires that we've been dealing with over the last month. So let me start with a few projects just to give you a flavor of some of the things we've been up to. One of the things we do every summer is a lot of paving work that can only be done during the dry, warm season of summer. As traffic increases, we do more and more of that work at night, and our major highways now almost exclusively has become night work. One of the things is we've dealt with some of the major paving projects you may have encountered this summer, one north of here between Woodburn and Wilsonville. There's another one on 205 that we're doing at night and one near in the Albany area. All those are night work. But one of the things that we've been running into is just the window of opportunity for contractors to actually perform the work. Typically, historically, we've been able to go down and reduce lanes and get the contractor out there working by 7, 8 o'clock at night, and they're able to work till 6 in the morning and get a full shift of work in and miss the PM and the AM peak. But as traffic volumes have increased, we're now not able to get out on some of our busier highways till maybe 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night, and we have to be off by maybe 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, which does not give our contractors a full even shift for them to do their work. By the time they set their traffic control up, take their traffic control down, their actual paving window is maybe 4 to 6 hours on a given night, which just lengthens the time that we're out there, the exposure, the inconvenience that we're out there in front of the motoring public. So I think as a result of some of the things we learned this summer, we're going to be taking some new approaches to how we look at our paving work. You may know at various times in the Portland metro area, we've actually completely closed freeways for several days over a long weekend and had a contractor out there working 24/7 to get the work done. That type of approach and other approaches is where we're going to be in the future, just given the traffic volumes and the challenges that we have in getting the work done. This particular project I got pictures of here, the Wilsonville to Woodburn, was a Knife River project. They actually had an employee that was killed on the job early on in this project. You may remember back in late June, they had a distracted driver going through the work zone and killed somebody. So the work that we do here, whether it's distracted driving, whether it's safety laws, make a profound impact for those workers out there doing the work at night in very hazardous conditions. Next project I want to touch on is Newburgh-Dundee. It's one we've talked about for some time. It's a Jobs and Transportation Act project, over $200 million project. We've divided up into different phases. We're on the last phase of that project and hope to have a ribbon cutting later this fall, probably in the November timeframe. Just to give you a sense of how this is taking shape, this is a recent aerial photograph of the area. To get you orientated in the lower left here, this is 99W coming from Portland and looking to the south. So my cursor is going through Newburgh, through downtown Newburgh, and then up here is Dundee. And here you'll see where the new bypass is taking off as we kind of snake through some farmland here. go around the paper mill in between the neighborhoods, past the airport, connect into 219 at this location. As we talk about phase two of the bypass, it takes off from this location and goes to the north, connecting back to 99W. But this section in here is ready to be open. We're doing the final touches on a temporary connection here on Springbrook, which will serve as a connection to the bypass until we get the phase two of the bypass complete. This Saturday, we have an event for the community to come out and play on the bypass, and just for the community to see the work that we've been doing over the last several years. A lot of it's been done kind of behind the curtain, and a chance to kind of open that curtain and for the people to really see what we're going to be able to experience once we open the highway again later this fall.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Paul, could you go back to that map for just a moment? You've got the temporary connector to 99 on Springbrook right now. Mm-hmm. I use that pretty much every day on my commute right now. That is going to go west off the bottom of the airport there, and it's going to continue out and then turn north to 99. Is that how that's going to layout?
The phase two of the bypass.
Phase two.
You're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the intersection they're building now that you drive by on 219.
Uh-huh.
It'll be another leg to that intersection. Eventually, the plan calls for a full interchange actually at that area. But the connection we've made there at 219, and then this phase two heads in this direction off my screen. There's a golf course in there. If you're familiar, it goes skirts through the golf course, makes some impact to that, and then makes a connection at 99W further to the north.
Has anybody done a study on whether that's going to increase commuter traffic southbound on 219 across the bridge and through St. Paul Donald, et cetera?
I don't have, Madam Chair, Representative Vile, I don't have the data on that, but I think everyone's anticipating that the increased traffic, and specifically truck traffic, using the Donald Rory interchange, not necessarily St. Paul, but using the Donald Rory interchange coming over on McKay Road, hitting 219 and then coming in that way as truck traffic, commuter traffic from Portland kind of heads to Lincoln City, Central Coast, the casino area, that will be a very popular route.
Rather than trying to come down 99 or across Tualatin, Sherwood Road.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why the community is interested in getting the phase two done, because once you build phase two, you've got more incentive than to stay on 99 and come through and use the total bypass. But in this configuration, we would anticipate a significant increase in traffic using that route.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Vice Chair Vile. And Mr. Mather, I think that there is could you touch on what's happening with phase two while you're on this slide?
Yes, Madam Chair, we've identified several phases as part of the entire EIS. There's more work to do actually to the south of Dundee, but the next phase, the phase two, would be as I described. There is some savings on the existing JTA project, about $10 million that our commission has approved to use for design and right-of-way purchase in that corridor. House Bill 2017, which recently passed, identified another $2 million, if I have my number right, to do additional design in this corridor in preparation for hopefully some construction money, whether we're successful through a federal process or additional state funds.
Great. Thank you.
Next project, one in Eugene, I-5 Beltline. This is a project that's been under construction in, again, several different phases. We're in the final phase of this project, building the final loop ramp and bike path connections, I-5 and Beltline. There's, again, some savings on this project we've been able to redirect to another need in the community for Delta and Beltline, and we'll be doing a operational improvement scheduled for 2019 in that area. So this is wrapping up there. You can see the flyover was built in the phase one, kind of the final pieces of this interchange coming together. Again, some of the night work we do setting the beams we've set this summer.
And Paul, this has been a long-term investment How many years has this been in process? It's been a very long time.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it started with the passage of JTA. It was one of our phase one of this project. Was one of the first ones we did back in probably 2010 is when this started. So it's of the four phases that we've done. It was part of the improvements in this entire area that the community has done to the east with the hospital that has come in, and the road improvements and other developments to the east is really what prompted these improvements.
Thank you.
Wickiup Junction. So this is Highway 97 in Central Oregon. If you know where La Pine is, just north of La Pine is the last at-grade railroad crossing on Highway 97 where it crosses the Burlington Northern Railroad. We're in the process of constructing an overcrossing in that area. We did much of the work last summer, putting the fills in place and starting to build the bridge abutments that was done. Anticipation of having those fills settle over the winter and then come back and put the finishing touches on. When we came back this last spring, we noticed that the settlement had occurred much more than we anticipated. And what was more alarming to us was the settlement wasn't decreasing, it was actually increasing in its rate of settlement. We called time out on the project, stopped the contract, brought in some expert consultants, brought in Federal Highway Administration from around the country to take a look at what was going on. We just are in the process of receiving some of the draft reports, and we'll be having a community meeting later this month or early next month to really chart a path forward of what that means for the project and where it's going. This is about a $16 million project. We're about $12 million into the $16 million project. So more to come on this project. Probably in a future update, I'll have more details to share with you exactly what we've found in this area and what our path is going forward.
So, Paul, I think what I'd like to do is flag for staff for our November meeting another informational hearing on what's happening with this project, because I think it's going to be of interest.
Yeah. I'll be
Patrick,
glad to come back.
So we'll go ahead and start our agenda with that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Highway 62 in Southern Oregon, major project in that area. Again, this will probably be the last of the JTA projects that get across the finish line. This is about a $100 million project. Again, we divided it up into a couple different phases for contracting. Knife River was the successful contractor in both phases. The first phase was this southern half here from Vilas back to Highway 62. Just to get you orientated, I-5 is in the kind of the bottom of the picture here. Medford proper is kind of on the bottom. This is the commercial area on Highway 62 with Walmart and Costco and so forth. This phase has been under construction now for two construction seasons. This top phase here has been under construction for just the one season. They both have a season to go to complete. Here's some of the bridge work happening there along Highway 62. You'll notice in these pictures, the smoke that's in these pictures, just what the Rogue Valley has endured probably more than anybody in the state, the amount of the smoke that we've had. Here's some of the other work going on further up the corridor. Staying in Southern Oregon, Grants Pass, Caveman Bridge is a project we're just kicking off. This is a historic structure that really the community identifies with. A lot of our McCullough bridges in particular, but bridges throughout the state, our communities identify with. And we think about those being on the coast, but they're also throughout the state. And this is an important bridge in this community that we're going to make about a $5 million investment in just doing an upgrade. This bridge was built in 1931 and really has not had any major rehab work on it since then. And this project will bring it up to speed. If you look closely on this picture, you'll see a Model T going across the bridge when it opened, and then some of the other pictures.
Madam Chair.
Bridge looks like today. We had a public meeting about the bridge, and some of the locals just showing their enthusiasm for the bridge came in costume.
And their caveman.
To support the bridge.
Representative Vile.
Yeah, I just think it's notable that both Representative Wilson and I grew up with this bridge, crossing it multiple times a day. And I wish you had a picture of me riding my bike over one of the arches when I was about 16 years old.
No.
Indeed.
That was just before McLaren, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Were you a witness representative?
It was a small town. We all were.
Well, we're not going to promote that.
Don't recommend
it. A multimodal agency, but maybe not quite that far.
Paul, what is the nature of the investment for the bridge? What has to be done
Madam
to
Chair,
it?
It's a little bit of everything. So it's rehabbing the deck. Some of the concrete is having some small spalling with it. We need to do some repair work with. It's really just a touch up on the entire bridge. It'll take about a year and a half to do. Some of the work will be done again at night as we do lane closures and so forth. And it is a very busy structure.
Thank you.
Again, you'll just notice the smoke in the picture as we try to get pictures from this summer. Scottsburg Bridge, another bridge project that we have coming up. We're in the design phase of this bridge. This bridge was identified in House Bill 2017 as receiving funds, $40 million for replacement. This bridge was built in 1929, again, back in an era where Model Ts and smaller vehicles were using this structure. Today's modern traffic of trucks and cars have much more difficult in using the sharp corners and narrowness of the bridge. This is a crash that happened last spring. A truck was coming around one of the sharp approach corners a little too fast. You'll notice this member of the bridge right here is what the truck struck. It wouldn't have taken much more kind of bending of that member without starting a chain reaction that would have brought the whole bridge down. So it was something that we all kind of held our breath to get the truck off and get those repair made and get the bridge back open again. Here's the picture of the bridge today. Some of the public meetings we've had, just to show you some of the alternatives that we go through and look at. The bridge today is right, the little white line right in here is where the bridge is today. The orange line is what we've selected through public input and just doing analysis on the bridge, but we did look at several different improvements to the area. I will also show you what we're working on relative to House Bill 2017 web pages for each of our projects. So this one is not quite compliant with House Bill 2017 yet, but it just gives you a feel for the type of information and website we're going to have on each one of our projects that we have. There's some old historic photographs down here and some others that are pretty kind of interesting to take a look at.
Thank you. Paul, I know you've had some interaction with some local folks on placement of this bridge structure. Would you like to?
Yeah, so it was interesting. We at one of our public meetings, there was a couple of Roseburg Forest Products loggers that came to our meeting and said we were logging up in, if you can see my cursor, up in this area right above the bridge. And we noticed several very large kind of house-sized boulders up there that didn't look very stable, and they asked if we were taking that in consideration when we were designing the seismic aspects of our bridge and worried about those rocks coming down in a large earthquake. Well, we started looking closer, and sure enough, there's actually several large rocks already in the river. Our assumption was they'd come downstream through some flood event, but actually in further investigation, they came and originated from that same place the loggers were talking about. So it's one of those things you discover in a bridge project that looks pretty simple and straightforward, and then you go to a public meeting and hear about boulders that could come down and take your bridge out in the middle of an earthquake that you're trying to make a bridge seismically sound. So we're having to kind of go back and do some work on the exact location of the bridge or mitigation to keep those rocks from actually coming down and striking the bridge in a major earthquake. But just, again, just a kind of a strange example of things that we deal with in design. So I'm going to shift from projects and talk about some of the things we've been doing over the summer, the eclipse and fires. And both these events are examples of emergency preparedness, of just the process that we go through. The incident management process that we go through is the same structure for decisions, for communications that we use in any event. It's part of the national training that was done after 9/11. So this is a protocol that's used nationally, whether it's a hurricane or a fire or an eclipse. It's the same basic structure goes into place, same roles and processes. Anytime we have opportunities to practice this, we do, and the eclipse was one of those that we used as a great practice event, even though it was a planned, kind of a planned event. It wasn't something that we woke up and dealt with that day. It gave us an opportunity to bring people in and get familiar with the process and the role that they would play in a major event such as an earthquake.
For the record, I should probably indicate when I opened this informational meeting, we started with an update on transportation projects. We're moving into the second phase of this informational hearing, which is wildfire impact of state highways and the eclipse. So just to make sure that the people who are maybe watching from afar understand, we've just shifted gears.
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. We did a lot of messaging out before the eclipse, and our message is really summarized here in the last piece, as we asked people to arrive early, stay put, and then leave late. The public did really well with the first two of those as far as arriving early and staying put. It was actually kind of phenomenal that weekend right before the eclipse, just how little traffic there really was. I drove through Portland back from our commission meeting in Enterprise on Friday afternoon at 5:30. I hit absolutely zero congestion going through Portland, drove 55 miles an hour without stopping at 5:30 on a Friday afternoon in Portland. It was almost unreal, the amount of, or the lack of traffic that was out there on Friday.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative McClain.
I want to talk about that for just a minute, because I think a lot of people thought there was not an event, that there really weren't any people that had come to the state to see the eclipse after all the hype. But I absolutely believe it was part of the messaging that you folks were doing.
Yeah.
Because I actually had folks who said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying home tonight, or I'm not going anywhere, period.
Right.
You know, and I really felt like that was a really good message and also really good preparation, as you say, for things that we can prepare for.
Right.
And so I just thought it was very successful.
Madam Chair, Representative McClain, yeah, we felt very good about our messaging that we were getting out. We learned some things about how we can communicate with the public for these types of events, and also felt good that our message was getting out, at least in the first two phases. Now, when we get to staying late, that piece of it was a little bit different, and we really, I think, kind of woke up to how many people were actually really here once the eclipse was over and everyone needed to find their way home. Here's just a photograph of the command center in Central Oregon and Deschutes County, the various partners and players preparing for that. We deal with the traffic side of things, but emergency services, when the highways are all clogged up, we still need fire and law enforcement and others to get out to do their jobs. So just that coordination is very, very important for us. There's a photo of one of the events outside of Prineville. This one was, I think, estimated to be about 30,000 people to show up, and they had all closer to 100,000 by the time they were done being there. So it was just an example of one of the events that was going on. We asked people not to park on the side of the road. here's a picture on 97 north of Terrebonne, where that message didn't quite get out, at least in this area. Here's just a picture of the impact right after the eclipse, just in Madras, of everybody leaving Madras. And this took, several days for this to clear out. We saw people that were kind of the day people that came were the first day. People with campers went the second day. It was amazing. The second day, the amount of campers on 97 was every other car was some kind of RV or trailer. It was pretty impressive to watch. Here's 395 in Long Creek, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. That doesn't really see really any congestion at all. The picture of the cars you see in this picture is probably the average daily traffic for this road. But we saw lines and lines of cars even on some of our most remote highways. In the valley, same thing. Albany-Salem area was kind of a central area for traffic. Not much on the coast. Just was, I think, people recognized the risk of clouds and so forth on the coast, that they aimed more for the valley. Here's some of the traffic on I-5. It wasn't unique to Oregon. You look across the country, you saw the same phenomenon happening right after the eclipse. As soon as that eclipse was over, you saw the red line starting to pop up in all the major communities across the path of totality. So turning to the fires, some of the more recent stuff that we have going on. This is the Chetco Bar Fire in Curry County. Actually, Curry and Josephine County, this fire affects. This picture is taken from an airplane about right on the coastline. That bridge in the center, there's Thomas Creek Bridge on 101, which is about 10 miles north of Brookings. Much of this area was under at least a level 2 evacuation, if not a level 1 evacuation, for some time with the fire that was in this area. This particular fire didn't have a lot of impact directly to the highway other than the extremely smoky conditions, but certainly it did have on the community in that part of the state. The North Umpqua Cray Lake area had a number of fires. Seemed like we had several major fires, and once they get a handle on those, new ones would pop up, and they would get those under control just in time for the other ones to flare back up again. We had Highway 138 closed for over 3 weeks because of just the debris that was coming down on the highway. We think about closing the highways and kind of letting the firefighters in there. But just a reminder, our folks are also out there and need to be out there to keep the highway open so the firefighters can do their job. The firefighters are obviously on the front line, but I describe our folks as kind of being on the front lines of support of being out there. I was talking to our manager of this area a couple nights ago and sharing with me, he said over the last 33 days, he's had 3 days off in just the time that they've spent out there trying to keep the road open and continuously having these trees and rocks come down in the roadway. Here's a picture of one of their stockpile sites where they're stockpiling all the debris that's been coming down on the highway. St. Evan Junction, again, a number of fires in the area. We had one right along the highway Labor Day weekend where it was closed and then flagging traffic. I was actually stuck in part of this backup myself. But other than smoke and that delay, this highway, the San Diego Pass, has stayed open most of the summer. The big fire recently and the kind of impact to the interstate and certainly its proximity to Portland, the Eagle Creek Fire, is one we continue to deal with. As we even today, we still have eastbound of I-84 closed. Westbound has been open for several days, but we still are struggling with eastbound. One of the big struggles that we have with eastbound is the Tooth Rock Tunnel, if you're familiar with that area, right around the Bonneville Dam. This is where the westbound lanes actually go around this area on a bridge and through a tunnel here. This piece up here is actually the old highway, which we've turned into a bike path. If you look very closely, right in here is a light spot right there. That didn't used to be there before the fire. And so now what's happening, all the rock that comes off the slope is being funneled right through that spot and coming right out the portal of this tunnel. So as you come out the tunnel, you run the risk of, a shower of rocks coming down. So we're working to, seal that up and provide some kind of protection there from that from happening. But just one of the kind of many examples that we're struggling with to kind of get this back open and safe. Here's some more photos just around the tunnel. This is the westbound lanes that are now open. Mm-hmm. Just some of the amazing work the fallers have done to clear some of these slopes. So here you see them very low in the picture here. They're actually roped off with their chainsaws, cutting trees as they rappel down this very, very steep slope to get those burned trees off of there, that they don't come down on the highway. This is the old highway, the bike path up on top of the tunnel. We've had bridge inspectors out there looking for damage to our bridges. Fortunately, on the main line of I-84, we did not find any damage that was not true on the bike path or on the old highway. Significant damage to the pathway, guardrail burnt, bridges, damage to the bridge. It'll be some time before we even have a chance to get a full assessment of the damage that was done to the bike path area.
Paul, can you go back a couple, back there, one more forward? Oh. The one that had the rail line underneath. That just begs the question, I'm assuming that the FRA, the UPB, and SF were out inspecting their lines, too, for damage. Was the rail line closed as well? What was happening with the rail while this was going on?
Yeah, Madam Chair, they are part of the incident command structure and communication structure, so they're operating their railroad. But as we fall trees across, and they are worried about trees in our right-of-way falling on their road, sure. On the road, we're in full coordination back and forth. When I was up there, they were running trains, but they were on a slow order going through the area. So it's been the rail line has been open, but in a slow order and in a cautious way. But they are in coordination and communication with us and the incident command as we do our recovery.
So the impact on moving freight wasn't just trucks.
Yeah. Well, and also that's navigation right. as well too. At a time, the navigation on the Columbia was shut down as well.
Patrick.
A neighbor of mine is an engineer that runs the Hermiston-Portland line, and they were closed for a day and a half, 2 days.
Oh, okay.
They were operating trains running water tankers from Hermiston to the gorge, I understand, to help with some of it, for some of it. So there was at least a day or two entire disruption of that line.
Okay, thank you. Representative McLean.
Well, we had the trucking industry on the radio this morning. You were talking about what was happening in the last 3 weeks as far as their industry between especially Hermiston and Portland,
right.
And the fact that it was adding, you know, close to 3 hours to their travel time. And, of course, with all the, you know, you can only be on the road so much, mm-hmm. and you've got a trip that's 3 hours longer, then, you know, that was definitely impacting them. But is there anything that that we're trying to do as far as prioritize, you know, some of the road, you know, issues like the ones you've just described on I-84, or is there some kind of a timeline that we're trying to figure out, you know, because of the fact that it's economically hurting certain industries, or?
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative McLean, I'm going to get to that here in about two more slides, I think.
Perfect.
Get to that exact thing. But we are trying to prioritize things, and our goal is to get the road back open. In fact, it'll probably be open in some single-lane configurations rather than two lanes, so we're working to make sure it's safe, though, too, before we get the roadway back open. One of the other things that's been difficult in our decisions of opening and not opening, we're opening a freeway through an area that's in a level one evacuation, level three evacuation. So when you have the community of Cascade Locks or part of the community evacuated, but we have the freeway going through there, and the worry of those people in the community about people in the freeway getting off the freeway and vandalism and those types of things.
Sure.
It's different than a snowstorm closure.
Yeah.
And we got to think through some of those coordination things with evacuation orders and other things. We've closed all the exits for westbound, so if you're westbound today, you can only get off at Cascade Locks. You can't get off any of the other exits through there just because of those kind of concerns.
Great.
I was at the Oregon Truckers Association conference Friday and had a side conversation with a gentleman who is in Hermiston running a warehouse operation. I think the economic impact of this fire on some of our industries is undetermined at this point, but it's going to be significant. They had to run all those trucks to the south end of Mount Hood, and I know it created an inordinate amount of traffic on a highway that doesn't normally have that amount of traffic, and again, it cost them times money,
right.
And it was significant.
Yeah,
and I don't want to lose sight of the fact. The other thing I want to just, for those of us who live in more remote parts of the state that are impacted by fire, which is very different than the gorge, down on the South Coast, all those small industries, those small businesses who rely on people coming to the coast for boating and rafting and fishing and all of the recreational opportunities lost half of their season, and their season is about 3 months long.
Right.
So
right.
I just want to make sure we all understand that these have very far-reaching significant impacts economically, and it's for communities large and small.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Paul, back to the bridge issue again. Did I understand you to say that we do not know of any structural problems on bridges along I-84?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. Yeah, we did a bridge inspection of all the bridges, and the bridges are good to go as far as opening. Right now we're worried about rocks and trees coming down on the highway, but from the bridge standpoint, we're good on the main line of the interstate, not on the old highway.
Right. Very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Questions? Thank you.
So here's just a little bit on the old highway. Again, severe damage to the old to the old highway that we really haven't done a full assessment even to know when this would be back open, trying to keep it open for local residents, but for people wanting to see or use the gorge, it'll be some time before that's back open again. Here's one of the tunnels that we spent several million dollars on rehabbing just a few years ago that was lost in the fire. Again, our maintenance folks are out there on the front lines of support for the firefighters. We had this person in a snowplow going back and forth just to keep the old highway passable for those fire trucks, and was also instrumental in keeping this open for the rescue of the hikers early on in the fire. Here's just a shot of kind of the work that's being done out there. If you're familiar with McCord Creek, that's where this photo's taken, but it's pretty typical of the work we're doing. We've cut down thousands of trees. I think last count I saw was 3,000 trees. And you can see some of the work here to cut the trees down. And then on these slopes, it gets really difficult.
So, Paul, this might not be a question for you. It might be for the Department of Forestry, but how much of that is salvage logged? Is any of those logs marketable?
Madam Chair, the work that we're doing, as you can see, the quality of those logs and the size of those are really not. We put the previous picture you saw on the North Umpqua was pretty typical. They're, you know, three quarters burned and sometimes still on fire. We chip those up and use the mulch, but not from a lumber production standpoint. They're not valuable.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Vile.
And just as a follow-up to the chair's question, about how much of this is being done with state resources versus private contractors?
Madam Chair, Representative Vile, most of this is private contractors. We have a couple of fallers from ODOT that are out there, but we bring in much more experienced fallers in this area. It's some very, very complicated hazardous conditions to bring in. Most all this work is done by contractors. We're more, again, a support role for the contractor for traffic control, coordination, oversight of the work. Most of the actual work is being done by contractors.
Thank you.
So here's some photos that were just taken yesterday, and this is really kind of our last problematic area that we're trying to get a handle on to open the freeway. If you're familiar with I-84, the Shell Rock Mountain area, this is that slope. There's some trees on this slope. You can see some of them here that are partially burned. One of them has come down through our protective fence and wall onto both lanes of the freeway and actually into the westbound lanes. If you look on the freeway, that picture's taken right about there. We asked our contractor on the job to go out and see if he can take those trees down. He took one look at it and said no, they're not able to have the expertise to get out on that slope. Bonneville Power Administration has some experts, repelling type fallers that they called up, and we had them go out there. They made it about halfway across that slope and turned around and said, we're not going to be able to get those trees down either. So we're kind of scratching our heads a little bit of what to do. Our latest plan is to build some kind of temporary catchment down here at the bottom to catch those trees when they do come down off that slope. This will be an area likely you'll see at least a lane closure on the freeway to provide a little buffer for safety when we do open. Best case scenario would be later on this weekend we'd have a lane open in each direction in this area. So, but we're getting a handle on it. This is the last piece, unless Mother Nature does something else to us with the debris flow or something else yet with the rains we experienced last night or today. Should be kind of our last piece that we've got to work through. But I will add, though, that we will see mud flows, rock falls, trees on the highway all winter long. For those that use this area, I pay attention to trip check and just watch, because there will be likely numerous closures as we go through the winter and get through the next chapter of this disaster. That's my last slide.
Questions for Mr. Mather? Great. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Representative Vile.
Going back to the major transportation projects conversation earlier, can you just give us a real quick overview of what ODOT's doing to implement 2017, House Bill 2017, and just what planning, what kind of priorities are being set, et cetera. Just a real quick.
Yeah.
You know, Representative Vile, what I may suggest, and Paul, please feel free to give us a very short version, but we might invite the director back in November to come and actually right. do an in-depth. I had a conversation with them this week. They're putting their plans into place. I think by November we could get a pretty comprehensive update from ODOT about that. So
that'd be wonderful.
If you're willing, Patrick, can you flag that for us for November?
Okay. Madam Chair, the one thing I would like just to add to the response to that question, our commission on Friday is going to be adding a significant amount of projects to our STIP, or our capital program. And our aim is to get as many projects with the funding that will be starting to come in January out to contract this summer. And so we've kind of lined up those the projects that are named in the bill, as well as the funding that we'll see in the first part of the bill to get a jump start on those projects and get those going. So there's certainly a lot of activity in the department to get positioned, but the director will do a much more comprehensive view. But just to point that out, that action this Friday by our commission will be key.
Representative Barreto, did you?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I was just going to ask Paul, westbound I-84 or eastbound I-84. So is that, when is your, when will that be open? You said maybe one lane later this week or next.
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, I think at the earliest this weekend we'd have that open. Again, we're trying to get a handle on this particular spot, and we were still in the kind of the brainstorming mode yesterday trying to figure that out, and we think we got a path forward as to how we would do that, but we'll see how that plan comes together. If it comes together as we think it should, like I said, the earliest would be this weekend, but we'll see what the weather does to us, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. One quick question, Paul. Going back to Caveman Bridge, most of that work going to take place at night?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, yes. Anything that has to do with lane closures will all happen at night. There'll be activity and work during the day, but nothing that impacts traffic.
All right, great. Thank you.
Representative Noble.
Just a quick comment. I want to thank you for all the work you're doing. Even though I've been throughout my career working with ODOT, mostly in traffic safety, this committee has probably brought a little bit more of a closer look, and you didn't touch on any of the maintenance that occurred,
right.
But I saw a lot of maintenance going on in my neighborhood. And then just another shout out for Play on the Bypass this weekend.
Yeah, it should
be fun.
If
you're in the area, please show up.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah,
we've had those events and other projects, and they're a fun event for the community to get out and see a project before we actually open it up.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks.
And moving to the third section of our informational meeting is an overview of 2017, the distracted driving law. We passed House Bill 2597, and I'd like to invite Ms. Joyce up to give us an update on where we are with that. This has certainly become a topic of conversation in my district about this being a significant issue. So I appreciate you being here, Amy.
Well, thank you, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation on behalf of the department and specifically our Transportation Safety Division. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about this important piece of legislation. And I think that the charge was to talk about the bill itself, what the new law is coming up, and then some of the outreach that ODOT and others are doing to inform the public about the changes of the law. But I do want to take us back, with the chair's indulgence, a little bit to how we got to the introduction of a new bill, an amendment to the current cell phone law, at the beginning of the 2017 session. So during the 15-17 interim, the director of ODOT, Matt Garrett, along with the Oregon State Police and AAA jointly formed a task force on distracted driving, recognizing that it is what many, including our director, refer to as an epidemic of distracted driving and the safety implications from that. I'll talk about the task force in a moment, but I want to take even a step back from that time period to early in the 15-17 interim time period. We were seeing a large increase in the number and rate of highway fatalities in Oregon after really historic, literally historic lows in the number of fatalities on Oregon highways. As of 2013, it was the lowest number of fatalities since the 1940s. and the lowest rate of fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled in history for this state. So coming from historic lows in 2013, in October of 2014, we started to see an increase in fatalities in both the pure number and the rate. And I looked back, and literally exactly 2 years ago, in September of 2015, I and Paul Mather and OSP were before the Senate Transportation Committee talking about the huge increase in fatalities. And the rate at that point for 2015, year-to-date, we were up 30% in fatalities at that time period in 2015 over the prior year. And one of the noticeable items, there was a ton of data presented at that time and that we researched, but noticeable was the number and rate of roadway and lane departure crashes that really had no explanation. The pure number of roadway and lane departure crashes, fatalities, was large. But once you excluded things like intoxication, speed, lack of seat belts, no other explanation. We had 50 or 60 roadway and lane departure fatalities in that time period. That led to the department commissioning a study by Southern Oregon University into distraction, distracted driving, and what we could find out about people's behaviors and people's attitudes about distracted driving. And what that study found was 75% of people in that study admitted to driving distracted when they were alone in the vehicle. 44% admitted to driving distracted when they had passengers. And fully 84% themselves felt uncomfortable when they were a passenger and witnessed the driver of the vehicle driving distracted. So we recognize that there's this huge number of people admitting to driving while distracted. And another piece of data that we found was what we believe to be likely is that the number of fatalities and crashes where we can clearly identify that somebody is driving while they are distracted using a cell phone, the number where we know it for sure is very low. But it's the kind of thing that is, we believe, unknown and really unknowable. Because when you have a fatality, particularly when it's a single vehicle crash, and the person who is driving is killed, you can't ask that person whether they were using a cell phone. Without a warrant, you can't go and find out from the cell phone company whether that person was operating the vehicle while using it. But we have this large number of roadway and lane departure fatals with no other explanation. We believe a high number of those are due to distraction. So again, all that information led to the convening of this distracted driving task force. And coming out of that, among other recommendations, was that the current cell phone law in Oregon needed to be updated. So one of the factors there was that there was a Oregon Court of Appeals decision in 2015 that really, according to law enforcement, really tied their hands in terms of how they could enforce. Roughly, the Court of Appeals decision was, unless the officer observes the person actually speaking into the device or actually tapping into the device, they cannot be cited for distracted driving. So you could see a person with a phone up to their head with the glowing light. That's not enough. You've got to see them actually talking into the phone. And it's hard enough to see somebody driving with that phone. You know, people will drop it or they'll kind of have it down in their lap, all the things that probably all of us have seen people doing. So the enforcement was becoming very problematic, and even more so than it already is by its own nature. So the recommendation coming out of that distracted driving task force, on which sat two legislators, Representative Olson and Senator Courtney, was a bill to do a number of things. This was House Bill 2597, and as introduced, it did a number of things. First, it said that we're not going to prohibit just cell phone and texting. We're going to prohibit all electronic devices. So it's no better to be sitting reading your Kindle while you're behind the wheel than it is to be on a cell phone, and yet that wasn't part of the law. So let's prohibit use of all mobile electronic devices. The second thing the bill has introduced did was eliminate most of the exceptions that were in the law as it sits today. The bill has introduced did that, and then the third thing that the bill did was to increase the penalty for a conviction for operation of a vehicle using a mobile electronic device, increase the penalty. So now, as introduced, increasing it to a higher level of violation and increasing the fine. And then the fourth thing the bill did, as introduced, was allow a court to send the person to a distracted driving course, and if they pass that course successfully, their fine would be waived. Not the conviction. The conviction would still stay on the record, but the fine could be waived. As the bill progressed through the session, and Vice Chair Vile is well aware, having been part of the Judiciary Committee, which wrestled with this for quite a long time during session, the bill changed somewhat through the House, through the Senate, two committees in the Senate. But how it came out is effective October 1, so just about 2 weeks away, less than 2 weeks away. The general prohibition is you're not supposed to be using a mobile electronic device while you're driving. You can't have it in your hand, and you shouldn't be using it either. Something that is built into your vehicle, so the newer vehicles with the console thing, that is not covered by the bill. We're talking about mobile devices. And then through the bill, there are various versions. There are exceptions or affirmative defenses, which one would, in theory, need to prove in court if the officer didn't believe you at the side of the road. But the kinds of things that are either a defense, an affirmative defense, or an exception are things like hands-free, one swipe or one touch. So, for example, if you've got your cell phone in that bracket on the dash, and maybe you're using the GPS, if you hit it once or swipe it once, that's going to be acceptable under the law. That's an exception. Ham radio operators over the age of 18. And I would also go back and mention that for the hands-free, also only if you're over age 18. If you're under 18, you can't use the device at all. In the case of emergency, if you have a medical emergency and no one else is in the car that can call for you, you can exercise that emergency exception. Operators of emergency vehicles, that sort of thing. So those are the primary exceptions in the law. The bill also increased the penalties even more than had been proposed in the introductory version of the bill. So a Class B violation for your first offense if you aren't involved in a crash. A Class A violation if it's your second offense within 10 years, or if it's your first offense and you're involved in a crash. For your third offense in 10 years, that is a misdemeanor and a minimum $2,000 fine. And then remaining in the bill as it was passed was this option for a court to send a person to distracted driving avoidance class and then have their fine waived. Again, the conviction or the ticket remains on the record, but you can get your fine waived. And ODOT is currently working on administrative rules to set standards for that kind of a course. That was a requirement of the bill as well. So, again, as a reminder, a cell phone law has been in existence in Oregon for essentially 10 years. So the changes coming up October 1 are changes. It's not a brand new requirement, but it does expand the coverage of the law to things like other electronic devices, your tablet, your handheld GPS, your laptop computer, whatever else you might have as a mobile electronic device in your car. So it expands that coverage. It increases the penalty. It reduces the exceptions. And again, drawing it back to that 30,000-foot level of how we got here, this is about safety. This is about reducing the number of crashes, the number of fatals, saving lives on Oregon roads. That's what this law was about.
Ms. Joyce, thank you. That was a very comprehensive overview of what's happening on October 1st. I have a couple of questions. The first one is, how is your shop getting the word out to the public that in, you know, a very brief time the law's changing?
Right. Thank you, Chair McEwen. So a number of things are going on. Using federal funds that are directed specifically to our safety division for distracted driving prevention, we've done a media buy for billboards, radio ads, bus shelters, buses, social media to get the word out. That came together very quickly, and that that media push is already out on the street. We're also folding this information into the various trainings that our safety division does. So we train law enforcement, we train courts, we train teen drivers, or we provide materials for teen drivers who are about to get their license for motorcycle safety courses. So that's all being folded in there. We're looking at including this on our variable message signs that typically you'll see them in a construction zone. We're looking at using those to get the word out. And then on the 29th of this month, we're having a press conference outside of the Capitol. Inviting media. We'll have a couple of legislators there. I confirmed our Senator Courtney and Representative Olson, the primary, two of the main participants in the bill and the Distracted Driver Task Force. AT&T will be there with their simulator and really get the push out to the media about the fact this is coming October 1. And again, not a brand new law. Everybody knows they should not be using their cell phone or texting when they're driving, but this is an additional item, and that the enforcement, you know, may be more robust because law enforcement will once again have the better ability to identify that and write a ticket for that because the law has been cleaned up post Court mm-hmm. of Appeals decision in 2015.
Do you have any specific outreach to our high school students whom this will impact differently? When you mentioned the 18 and unders or the under 18s, mm-hmm. I'm wondering how we reach out to through the Department of Ed as a partnership. And so, how are we telling our teenagers that they need to put their phones in their glove box or in the trunk?
Chair McEwen, three points on that. One is that's an excellent suggestion, and I'll be talking based on that with our safety division folks about how we might partner with Department of Ed.
Thank you.
Again, part of the media outreach is a large, I think Facebook is the primary social media outreach platform that we're using with our advertising partner. But I would also mention that it is not just our teens who are using these devices. It is a significant problem for, I will say, folks of perhaps my age, the sort of, mid-20s to late 40s kind of era. To some degree, we believe that teens have sort of grown up with this message that they shouldn't be doing this. Now, whether they listen to it or not or obey it or not is one thing. But we do find in the data that a number of people committing this offense are not your 16, 17, 18-year-old kids. It's all of us. So, yes, we need to focus on those youngsters, but it is all of us who are doing this behavior.
Representative Noble.
I have a question. I don't know if this has been brought to your attention at all or with removal of some of the exemptions, which I think was probably very wise, even from a public safety standpoint, now it's tied to actually while you're performing duties as opposed to just having an exemption. What was raised to me is as people were moving, farmers were moving combines, large pieces of equipment on roadways this summer, it occurred to them that they are no longer exempt, and they have no way currently to communicate crossing bridges, around corners, and as you're moving these large machineries in this machinery and the convoys, no way to actually create a safe environment to warn people. Have you had any type of feedback like that from other large vehicles moving? Because a lot of those exemptions are gone, except for specific instances, forest products, logging. But some of the other exemptions for moving equipment on the highway have been removed.
The wide
any
load.
Feedback there?
The wide load that has a pilot car.
Wide load with pilot cars, because that, unless they're moving something to do with logging, as I read it, they can't use their handheld radio unless they are a ham radio operator.
Chair McEwen and Representative Noble, again, the hands-free option is still available. CB and two-way type radios for CDL holders, commercial vehicles, that still exists. I am told, at least with the pilot car situation that was raised during session, that there is a hands-free option there. But I have not heard anything specifically from the agricultural community about the bill, either really during session or post-session.
Just a quick follow-up, because I actually, this was a meeting I had last night with some people in the Farm Bureau in my community, and I had the same exact answer, and they said, well, actually, combines don't have a hands-free option, and the noise is such that they need something at the ear. So it may come up. I mean, I think there's a safety issue there without allowing it to be abused as an exemption, just a flat-out exemption.
Yeah.
Chair McEwen and Representative Noble, I would also note, and I haven't been in a combine or a large piece of agricultural machinery, but the exclusion from the law of built-in devices. Now, what I described in my presentation was, you know, maybe in a nicer, newer car, you've got that, you know, touch screen console, and that's excluded from the law. But things like a built-in radio, a built-in two-way radio, and by built-in, it doesn't have to be manufactured in. And there was quite a bit of legislative record created on the floors about what we're talking about there. So I'd be happy to work with the Farm Bureau about what kind of questions they have, about what kind of devices those folks are using and whether that looks like it's covered by the law or not. And I'd be happy to engage law enforcement as well.
It's something I didn't even think about.
Absolutely.
At all. So this is just brought to my attention last night, so it's timely, I thought I'd ask.
Thank you. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Just three, hopefully, quick things. First of all, thank you for what you're doing. I am reminded, though this is not exactly the same, but I'm reminded of one of my first duties in the Air Force of having to explain to very experienced master sergeants and tech sergeants that they should stop smoking and drinking. It would be healthy for them. And it was a duty I did not want, and they did not really want to hear. But nonetheless, it was done so that perhaps we might actually help them get a longer life and a healthier life. I voted for this measure because at the end of the day, after a lot of thought, I figured it might save a life or two. But I want to be very clear. I still believe that the policy itself is in many ways painting the grass green instead of actually growing the lawn. Studies that I am aware of that have not been challenged say that whether you are hands-free or not hands-free, if you are engaged in a conversation, especially with this younger generation, if you are engaged in a conversation while driving, that is the distraction, not the actual little device. And my concern on this is, as a person who really does not like telling people what they can or cannot do in a vehicle as long as they're not disobeying the other laws of the road and putting themselves at harm, when this comes back and we don't miraculously save 30,000 lives a year, what's next? And I just want to put a marker there. This is as far as I go. I am not convinced that it will save as many because I think it doesn't actually solve the underlying problem. I don't have a solution for the underlying problem. But my concern is when we look at something, we come up with a solution and say, all right, it's now fixed. People's expectations rise. And I think most people, most parents especially, will be okay with higher fees, even if they have to pay them themselves because they were on the phone talking, trying to get kids from place to place, because it may save lives. But I want a clear, honest, open-eyed assessment 3 years from now as to whether this actually worked, and when it doesn't, we need to have a different conversation. That's all I wanted to say.
Representative McLean.
First, I wanted to talk just for a minute about what Chair McEwen said, because what she said was, how are we, she didn't say that she didn't believe that teens were the only ones that were not doing, you know, was involved in this activity, but that we needed to be especially clear with them, because if they're under 18, they're not supposed to be on it at all. And she used the trunk or the glove compartment as a place where your phone should be. And especially because there are many of those teens that will not have a shiny, fancy new car that has the options that you described as being okay, you know, that hands off. And so many of them are going to think, well, I'm hands off, so, or I'm not hands off. And so that tells the story. But in your situation, you were saying it's the age that tells the story on what the law is. And so I think it needs to be really clear in that educational material that there are two situations. There's hands-off, hands-on for a certain age, and there's don't use at all, unless that was not your message.
Chair McEwen and Representative McLean, that is the law. And that is the law today. The hands-free exception is only for those 18 and over. So that's not changing. That continues. But I agree. And I didn't want to imply by my earlier statement that teens don't need outreach. I was trying to make the point of this is something that is done by everyone. But certainly, I think it is well received that we need to look at how we can reach teens. But the law today, and has been for the better part of 10 years, that until you're 18, you don't even get the hands-free exception.
And I would just tell you that not too many of them know that, just clearly do not know that. And, you know, ignorance is not an excuse. I'm just saying I think we need to make, this is another opportunity for us to get that law understood. So that my second one was that I've been hearing Uber, Lyft, and taxi drivers, like the egg community that may or may not have an issue, are wondering if they have an issue, mm-hmm. because they don't believe they fit under the emergency as far as picking up rides, dropping off rides, and doing some of the things that they think they need to do to be able to do business. Mm-hmm. And so I want to make sure that there's some dialogue about that as far as, you know, where are we on that conversation?
Chair McEwen and Representative McLean, right, so we were contacted by a reporter 2 days ago or Friday with concerns from the driver community. Now, I will say that in some of those contacts, the implication was that some of this stuff was snuck in at the end of session. I can tell you that you know, the bulk of this law was there from January on. There were 3 public hearings. I am told that the corporate Uber and Lyft folks, their folks have stated that they believe that their drivers can operate well within the law as it is. I would say clearly they do not qualify for the emergency exception unless they're experiencing an emergency. But in the business model where, as I understand it, the drivers, once they get an alert, have to very quickly, you know, accept the ride or they lose it, or they might suffer some penalties for not accepting enough rides in a certain period of time. Again, that one touch, one swipe exception seems to fit that perfectly. And I believe, you know, those folks or that kind of situation may have been actually contemplated. That exception was added into the law via amendment after session began. So, you know, that seems to be covered.
Last one. The only other item that I've heard that people are confused, and then you said the word today, so you called it a holder. and you pointed as if it was going up on the dash. Is there something in the law that says that your phone actually has to be in a holder?
Chair McEwen and Representative McLean, no. I would say that, just sort of as a best practice, I guess if it's down in your passenger seat and you're doing this, that doesn't seem to be very safe, but that's not prevented by the law. No, but that's a common thing that folks use, that bracket on the dash.
Thank you.
Representative Vile.
Real quickly, as a follow-up to that last observation, any of us that have ever flown know that heads-up displays have revolutionized the safety of a cockpit. And anything that gets your head up and keeps it up is a really important part of the process. I want to go on record as one who participated a lot in the discussions, both in committee and behind the scenes on this, and am appalled at the number of injuries and deaths that we're experiencing due to distracted driving, and really understand the sentiment that we've got to do something. I'm concerned because I fear that what we've done here, no matter how we frame it, isn't going to do the trick. I, along the lines a little bit of what Representative Evans was saying a moment ago, I hope we can develop data that does show that it made a difference, but we haven't addressed eating a cheeseburger. We haven't addressed that tap and swipe to either activate or deactivate a device or a function of the device. I can still see the person coming in and saying, no, I have to swipe on my Kindle to keep reading. That's a function. And as a trial lawyer, I think about what's going to happen when we get to in front of a judge on this. My sense is that we would be better off focusing on educating each other about the need to remain alert in the cockpit, in the driver's seat. All of this is going to change, even over the next few months, this is going to change. As autonomous vehicles come around, the idea that you're sitting in an autonomous vehicle, that NHTSA has given us all the safety features that essentially it's self-driving, and yet I can't touch my cell phone or I can't swipe a device in the vehicle. As a practical matter, none of that's going to work. And so I think this committee has a role to play in that safety on the road concept, looking at how we frame this in terms of overall attention by those operating a vehicle. And when we get these kinds of laws where the devil is in the detail of the wording and begin missing things, we just haven't really solved the problem. So
And Representative Vile, I think you bring up a very good point that this is a moving target. This is an evolutionary process because the industry is changing
so fast
at a rapid pace. So your point is very well taken. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. We're always going to be trailing technology, and that's just kind of the nature of making law. Typically, I don't like to vote for things like this, but I certainly did on this one, and again, I want to reiterate why. And that is, I think most of you remember from the 2015 session, I got in a whale of a motorcycle wreck over in West Salem, where I was taken out by a confused driver. A couple of months ago, during the height of the discussion on this bill, I was also riding again, and I was coming toward the Capitol on State Street at 17th, and I look at the person to the right of me, and they're doing FaceTime. And I look to the person on the left, and they're doing Facebook Live. And I'm just thinking to myself, this is crazy, because we don't get fender benders in the motorcycle business. Every time we get tagged, something gets hurt, and sometimes very badly. So although things like this traditionally go against my grain. That day made up my mind, you know, when I realized that we are addicted. We are absolutely and totally addicted to these things. And again, we're going to be trailing technology, but I know we'll do our best to keep up and keep within distance. But, you know, I feel good about what we've done. And, yeah, we'll have fix-its along the way, I know. But this is a good move.
Good move.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as we look at this, you know, this isn't something that's just common to Oregon, but to all 50 states. Are we looking at other states and just seeing what they're doing for policy in this area?
Chair McEwen and Representative Barreto, absolutely. Connecticut, a number of years ago, passed a very comprehensive distracted driving bill. Washington State, I'm sure you all saw it in the news just this past year, adopted a very tight distracted driving law that goes beyond devices to other things. So we are watching what other states are doing. We're paying attention to what the federal government requires in terms of receiving grant funding to do the education and outreach that is so critical to this effort. But yes, we're watching what they're doing, and we're watching their statistics as well. And hopefully, as we get further down the path, as Representative Evans indicated, you know, when we have some data, we can come back and report on what we are seeing as well as what other states are seeing.
Yeah. I'm going to go one step further with this. I've had some communications through my office in the last few weeks on an area where this impacts Oregonians in a different vein, and that is the cost of auto insurance. And if you look at what's happening with actuarial tables in that industry, crashes that used to cost X are now costing Y and Z for two reasons. One is the technology on the vehicles is very expensive to repair, so that's driving cost up significantly. And the second is the fact that distracted driving creates an event that is larger with greater injury than the normal fender bender used to. So the cost drivers of the kind of the intensity of the crash when it is caused by a distracted event and the cost of the technology on the cars is changing that industry significantly as well. So two things are happening here. And I think we're going to be hearing more about that as time goes on. So just another thing that I think Oregonians need to be aware of, that it's not just highway deaths, of course, is the key thing we're trying to prevent. But increase in cost to Oregonians is also escalating because of this issue.
Absolutely.
So I just wanted to flag that. And any further questions for Ms. Joyce?
If I may,
yes.
Chair McEwen, just a comment that I think in part responds to both Vice Chair Viles and Representative Evans' comments/questions. This bill is not a silver bullet. It's not going to prevent everyone from doing this bad behavior, just as speed limits don't prevent everyone from speeding. I didn't talk about the data about fatals from speeding, fatals from driving impaired, fatals from not wearing your seatbelt. All of that stuff happens every session. We've got more bills about how to combat DUII. So it's not a panacea. It's not a perfect bill. We believe it will have an impact. Also, I didn't talk about some of the other things that that are happening outside of this piece of legislation that came from the Distracted Driving Task Force. There are education efforts afoot. There's a positive message of healthy driving instead of telling people stop doing X, Y, and Z. There's a campaign around healthy driving and using competition and a technology app to use technology to combat technology, you know, compete to drive healthy. So there are a number of efforts going on, but it's not a panacea, but we believe that this is one step that's going to do some good.
I have one follow-up question now that I think Representative McLean piqued my interest with what's happening with teenagers. When a young person goes in and applies for their learner's permit or for their driver's license, does the DMV give them information about this? Is that part of their process of being certified as a driver in Oregon?
Chair McEwen, so to begin the process to get your permit as a teen, you have to take a knowledge test. And I believe there are distracted driving questions that are part of the random sampling of questions that are used. Once you have your permit as a teen, you can get your license one of two ways. The default way in the statute is to take a teen driver ed that is certified by ODOT Safety Division, which is a nationally recognized program, and they cover distracted driving a lot. The other way, if you choose not to take that, is to drive with a parent or an adult for 100 practice hours, and hopefully that information is being conveyed by the parent as well. But and certainly in the driving instruction book that the teen has to be able to take the test, to be able to learn how to drive, there's distracted driving information in there.
And distracted driving information would include the fact that in Oregon the law prescribes that they have no leeway.
Correct.
While they're under 18.
Correct.
So that's clear to them.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much for the questions. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
I'm going to close our informational meeting on updates from ODOT and move to a committee discussion. I don't know. Do I need to formally open this?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
All right. Committee discussion regarding possible LPRO research projects. We have a remarkable set of very qualified people in our LPRO office who are very interested in supporting this committee and doing research on any issues that you think that we may need to be looking at as we move into the 18 short session or even preparing for 19. What I'd like to do is just open this up for a conversation and see what's on your minds and see how we could direct Patrick and the LPRO staff to begin to look at some things for us. Yes, Representative Vile.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that's come up this summer in my district has been the interface between high-speed, high-powered speedboats on narrow rivers like the Willamette, and the impact on both the paddlers, the non-motorized boats, those that are using the river for commercial purposes such as fishing, crawdad harvesting, etc., and the impact on the banks as more and more of the really big, powerful, wake-producing vehicles or boats are on the river, especially in the narrower parts of the river. We're seeing significant environmental impacts, and I think that some research on how others around the country maybe have addressed these issues, what we might look at, particularly in discussing this with the Marine Board. That's something that has come up in my district.
Representative McClain.
I have a hard one that I don't know if there's any answer to, but we could research it, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm concerned about is the idea that 80% of our freight and products are basically going in trucks, and that there should be maybe a little more balance between trucks and trains and other, mobile opportunities, whether it be, through ports or whatever. And I was wondering if there could be maybe a research project looking at other states that are similar to us and have the opportunity of air and ports and trains and trucks and see what kind of incentives or what kind of systems are available in other states to allow, for example, not to have the conflict between passenger and freight rail. And we know why in Oregon that's happening, in some ways as far as the kind of rails we have, and we don't have a three-rail system, and we don't have side rails that are long enough to accommodate certain needs for getting some trains off the track. But I wondered if we could do something around the idea of the potential for rail to play a bigger part of our transportation system in both passenger and in freight work.
No, there may be a wonderful opportunity there with the two proposed transload facilities.
Yeah.
And the potential impact that those can have. I know the one in Representative Benz's district already has is influencing market decisions. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that that proposed facility is on the drawing board is changing some market dynamics already. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be an interesting thing to take a look at, certainly. And then the one proposed in the Mid-Willamette Valley. And Biz Oregon did kind of a study on that. I would argue that there were some pieces missing to that study, and maybe that could be built on to go one or two or three steps further, looking further down the road, not at current market conditions, but trying to project out further.
Okay. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. There's one bill that I'm probably going to be focusing on 2018 that certainly would benefit from a little bit of more information, and there's a couple of other concepts. First one has to do with some of the existing policies surrounding containment of hazardous materials and petroleum on trucks, not the train issue, but on trucks. The E. Wilson refuge that had a spill, there were some preventable technologies out there that I think it's time to look at. Other two things. One is from really an emergency response perspective, looking at how the Navy specifically handled Harvey and Irma, working with the chair and looking at the Coos Bay port for targeted investments mm-hmm. for resiliency so that when amphibious ships come in after a seismic event, we can support and sustain that in a way that is plug and play as opposed to having to scrape.
We'd be happy to work with you on that.
Yeah, I think that that's a logical place. And then the third thing is more local, and that's basically right now there is a very vocal element of part of the district that is very interested in, now the transportation package is done and we've secured the state or the Center Street Bridge, there is a very vocal group trying to find a way to get a third bridge across the Willamette into the capital city from West Salem or somewhere thereabouts. That process, I have some questions and I have some research ideas for potential solutions to some of the identified environmental problems. So those are the three things that I will be forwarding. And
thank you. Anyone else? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it would be interesting and hopefully beneficial to take a look at the impact that some of our major state arterials have when they pass through urban, suburban, and rural communities through the downtown heart of those communities, and the impacts on other traffic flow, commerce, pedestrians, et cetera, because there are some real challenges that result in what some people consider relatively high-speed highways going through the center of a community.
Thank you. You know what I might suggest is that each of you who have ideas make your way to Mr. Brennan and sit down and kind of flesh these out a little bit so he has, I think, the kind of the appropriate direction for the concepts that you have, if you don't mind. Would that be
Patrick? If I can expand on that, Madam Chair. Yeah. So there are, if and this applies for any committee you might be on, you can speak to the committee staff for that committee. If you have on other committees as well, I don't know if you're having these discussions in the other policy committees as well, but you can talk to us directly. You can correspond with us by email. You can call us up on the phone. And we're still working out some of the details, but you can make these requests open requests, or you can ask them to be. We're trying to work through our confidentiality mm-hmm. issues, but if you would like research done confidentially, you can also mention, it would be helpful if you would mention that to us, what your levels of expectation are about confidentiality, whether we're providing this directly to you once we complete a research project for you, or if we'd be providing it to the committee, if we'd be making it public on our website, or if we'd be not making it public on our website. We basically have all those options are available to you, depending on what kind of research you're interested in having done.
Representative McLean. My understanding was that there was a process that there would be even a form that you could fill out. Is that true? Or?
Yes. I'm not sure that there's an official form. I know that right now when we receive requests, we, by email is generally how we receive them, and we would we then submit them through a process that our office is developing.
And that process, do you accept it? I mean, you get a lot of requests, then do you accept them, and then do you have a timeline?
Or? Yeah, well, that's part of the process of that is, so if when you make a request, if you have a specific timeline or that you need for the request, or if it's an open one, just try to identify that when you make the request. And then, if, for example, if I receive an email request that's asking for a research project, I would correspond back with a requester and ask if there's a timeline and kind of give an idea of what my timeline might be, depending on because at this point, you never know when you're making a request. You never know if 19 other people may have already made a request right in front of you, and so you might not know what kind of like the overhead capacity is on that. So,
Representative
Byam. I just wanted to say I have one other item, but before we adjourn, if we're done with this matter.
I was just going to go to the good of the order, so you can be in the front of the queue.
This last couple of weeks, I've been troubled by the initial press reports from State Representative Herrera Butler out of Washington regarding
the
tolling issue, and now the letter signed on by a number of state legislators in Washington. I am anxious that somehow this doesn't escalate into a environment where we can't be talking with folks across the river. We've got to be talking to them. We are linked at the hip, and we can't avoid that. But I really think that if we can correct what I think is a very profound misconception on the part of the folks in Washington that somehow we're going to slap a toll on an existing piece of road that they come across and use that money to build a bridge in southern Oregon, it's just so ridiculous. And that word hasn't gotten there. And I'm wondering how we can possibly make sure that it's clear. I mean, we know under federal law we can't do that. Mm-hmm. We can't put a toll on an existing piece of road unless we maybe put a new lane on or make a modification. And none of that's getting through. So I just wanted to raise it as something that I think we've got to nip in the bud and make sure our conversations with Washington are positive.
Thank you, Representative Vile. Your point is very well taken. There is a great deal of misinformation out there. Representative McLean.
Well, my understanding is from the governor's office on down that most of us have the same opinion.
Concerned.
And that
mm-hmm.
the governors have already started conversations. And quite frankly, I do agree with you that it's important not just to clear up what the federal regulations are and what we can and can't do, but also the idea that if we're going to be partners in bridges and roads and corridors, that we need to also talk about the fact that what we're suggesting we might do as far as using tolls or congestion pricing has been done for 15 years in Washington and in California, and we're the only state that hasn't utilized that tool up to this point. So I think that conversation has to be out there, and maybe we should all have to take one or two phone calls and one or two legislators from Washington and just have a
conversation.
Hi, how are you? And you want to talk tolls and congestion. You know, but I agree with you.
I think
it's important to do.
Just if I can add to this, so
Mr. Brown.
Absent requests coming in from members for research, of course, we'd love to do self-directed research, and the one that I'm slowly inching my way to doing, the first one that I would do is an issue brief on tolling and value congestion pricing to kind of might help sort out some of these issues.
Great, that'd be good.
That'd be great.
And then we will have ODOT in front of us in 18 to do a report to the OTC and to us about how the implementation of 2017 rolls out in that regard. So very important that there's
clear information. I think she has a great deal of misinformation and is running with it, and you're absolutely right that we have work we need to do there. So thank you both. Anyone else? Well, then I think our first interim Legislative Days Committee is culminating. We'll see you all back here in November.
We'll see you tomorrow.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And oh, and those of you who are venturing over to the coast, you will cross the Scottsburg Bridge. So,
without it falling down.
Take a good look. We hope it doesn't land on your head. Watch out for boulders.
Oh, no.
So, Madam Chair.
Would you like to give us an update, Patrick?
Just real quick. Going to be sending, for those of you who have RSVP'd, kind of an updated itinerary that includes the relevant addresses for exactly where the Port of Coos Bay we're going tomorrow, where the address for the hotel
is being picked up at the hotel.
Yeah, and such, and also, of course, for benefit, where dinner will be tomorrow night.
And we're looking for, I can tell you that the port staff is looking very much forward to having you there, and travel safely, and we'll see most of you tomorrow. Thank you. We are adjourned. We'll see most of you tomorrow. Thank you.